Good morning. How are you? Could you tell me? Good morning. You're welcome. Good morning. You're welcome.
So we'll do the morning prayers in English. So the first is taking refuge. You have this booklet. And then when you say the refuge prayer, really think of your gurus and the Buddha and the space before you. So you can think of His Holiness the Dalai Lama or the historical Buddha, and think of their qualities, their excellent teachings, their ability to guide us and really help us transform our berserk minds into calm, compassionate, caring minds. Okay. With a sense of deep interest and gratitude, we'll say the refuge prayer. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in my gurus. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga will do a little bit slowly, you know, although I've done it many times before. This is really something like a regular daily practice that we can work on to cultivate virtuous energy and interest, and also to purify negativities. So Lama Tsongkhapa is, this is a statue here of Lama Tsongkhapa in the center with his two main disciples on either side. Lama Tsongkhapa lived in the 14th century and established, really, he was a great scholar, teacher, meditator, practitioner, and he really started the Gelupa order. Geshe-la's monastery, Ganden, was started in his time. So in the first verse, really think of Lama Tsongkhapa before you. And these words, Ganden Devas. Ganden is the land of joy, and Devas are enlightened beings, or heavenly beings. So petitioning these heavenly beings and Lama Tsongkhapa, from the heart of the Lord of the Ganden Devas emerges a brilliant white cloud like a great mass of fresh yogurt. Atop sits Tsongkhapa, all-knowing king of Dharma. We request your coming to this place along with your great disciples. My Lord Guru is seated before me on a lion throne, lotus and moon cushion. His white face smiles blissfully. Please remain many eons and serve as the supreme merit field for the growth of my mind of faith and for the increase of Lord Buddha's teachings. Your omniscient wisdom mind encompasses all that is existent. Your speech is a profound teaching which ornaments the ear of the fortunate. Your body's beautiful radiance evokes wondrous admiration. I prostrate to you, Lama Tsongkhapa, who merely viewing, hearing, or contemplating earns one great merit. So that first verse is one of prostrating, or really turning your mind, paying respect and bowing towards our teachers, and having a deep sense of aspiration for their qualities and to cultivate those qualities within ourselves. So this first one is prostration. The next one is offering. It's part of the seven limb practice. The second limb is offering, where you're offering, really purifying our sense of miserliness and lack. when we feel like we don't have enough. So really think about how you can offer things that are free and open to everyone. Or even if you have just a little bit, you know, if you have just one cracker, imagine breaking it and sharing it with others, you know? So it's really cultivating the sense of plenty, having a sense of plenty rather than lack. Okay, so in this offering, then you're also offering things that are really beautiful and that are pleasing to you. So again, the things of the five senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, mental views, things that are really inspiring to you, imagine offering those to Lama Tsongkhapa and to all beings everywhere. Okay? So think for a moment, all those things that are pleasing to you. And imagine offering that to Lama Tsongkhapa and all beings everywhere. I present to you, Supreme Field of Merit, Tsongkhapa, delightful offerings, pure sweet water, various flowers, fragrant incense, butter lamps, perfumes, and more, both physical and mental offerings, vast as the clouds and wide as the ocean. And the next line is the line of purification or real cleansing. Again, thinking about the aspiration to enlightenment, what we want to do is to purify all negativities and to accomplish all virtuous qualities. So this particular verse then is on purification. So what we want to do is purify negativities that we have committed in the past, actions by our body, speech or mind, no negativities that we've created with our body, like harming others, ripping others off, hurting ourselves and others, and then through our speech, divisive speech, slander, lying, gossip, which is the most insidious, because although it's probably perhaps the less overtly harmful, it's the one that we waste most of our time on. So really think about purifying those things that cause distracted, confused, segregated, biased mind. Okay, so think of that in your own what you would like to purify through this meditation. We'll just do a short one on that. So call to mind something that you would like to purify, whether it be by body, speech, or mind. And see it as really hanging you up, disturbing your own mind and the mind of others, creating negative karma, hardship, and then make a promise not to engage in that activity again or for a specific amount of time. Some amount of time that you can be successful in keeping your promise. And then dedicate it to the flourishing of your spiritual practice and the spiritual practice of others. And we'll recite that verse. The unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind I have accumulated since time without beginning, especially actions contrary to my three vows, Vinaya, Bodhisattva, Vajrayana, I regret extremely from the depth of my heart and reveal in each and every such action. So Vinaya are more like, you could say, the self-liberation vows, or the, for myself, it would be like our monastic vows, but for those of you who have taken refuge with Geshe-la, then it would be your vows of not to kill, steal, lie, not to commit sexual misconduct, or not to take intoxicants. So that would be your Vinaya vows. Bodhisattva vows are the promise to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, and taking up specific vows towards that end. And then the Vajrayana vows are the tantric vows that really are the promise to really become a Buddha for the benefit of others. It's a particular path and practice of attaining the qualities of a Buddha. So the next verse is one on rejoicing. They say this particular one is excellent for generating energy and enthusiasm, because you start thinking of the good things that you have done, and it just creates positive energy in ourselves and for those around us. So don't demean or belittle or discredit all the good actions that you have done in the past, you know, or even this morning. So even small, you know, small acts of kindness go a long way. They have a long distance effect. So really think about those for a moment, what you've done over this weekend already, and rejoice in them. So let's sit for a moment and think about those good actions, even if they were little. So acknowledge yourself and others for having engaged in those virtuous activities, and we'll recite the next verse. We totally rejoice in your magnificent achievements, my Lord. You strove for knowledge and realization, abandoned the eight worldly concerns, and made the most meaningful use of human life with the 18 opportune conditions during these degenerate times. Frank, what are the eight worldly concerns?
Fame and shame.
Good reputation, bad reputation. Loss and gain.
Loss and gain.
Pain and pleasure.
Pain and pleasure. Fame and shame.
Praise and blame. Yeah, okay. Eight worldly concerns. And when you examine those in the meditation classes, you see how we are run after one side of that set all the time and run away from the other. So how that affects us subtly and also profoundly in our, even in our spiritual practice, you know, when we're praised for anything, right? Worldly or spiritual, when we're praised, how it perks us up and we want to hear it again. What did you say? could you say that again? If someone is deriding or blaming us for something, what that does to our mental attitude. And so in our spiritual practice, really looking at how do we develop some kind of equanimity and even ground, regardless of what is coming down the pike to us, you know, whether it's praise or pleasure loss, gain, yeah? And you think, again, this the very subtle, insidious one of when pleasure comes into our life, you know, very high pleasure, and we throw our spiritual practice out the window then too. You know, sometimes it's because of a difficulty, you know. pain and suffering and negativities that arise. And again, we throw out our spiritual practice. No, to realize that our spiritual practice is to help give us some ballast in our actions and in our activities, whoever we engage in with our work, with our family, with our bodies, you know, all of these things, you know, how are we working with it? And so whatever happens, to see how am I practicing, how am I working with this, you know, that and really checking and observing, how am I holding my spiritual practice? You know, someone was just telling me that there are roommates with a student, and things were going well for a while until she couldn't get any more work. So she moved out, refused to pay her bills, you know, left a box of photographs of the Dalai Lama and other teachers in the rain outside, and said, "It doesn't work. I'm out of here." Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to observe in your own practice, you know, how are you holding your meditation practice? Because you know, if we're grasping onto it to give us something, you know, it can really backfire on us, especially when it's not working the way we want it to. Yeah, Buddhist practice is really about transforming the mind and looking at the condition of our existence. First noble truth is noble truth of suffering, and you know, it's like, yet what we're doing is running away from suffering as fast as we can, not grasping at every pleasure we can. So we need to really look and observe how we work and hold our practice. Okay, so we'll go to the next line. Again, this one is on requesting teachings. So I think based on what I was just saying, let's make our request to really try to understand our refuge and practice as well as we can, and that it be clear and motivated by excellent aspirations rather than by gimme, 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 and it's all focused on myself. Okay, so let's read the next verse. Pray, all you holy gurus, unerring in conduct, precipitate a rain of vast and profound Dharma from the billowing clouds of wisdom and compassion which fill the Dharmakaya sky, providing for the field of disciples precisely what is needed. And then the next verse is requesting our teachers to remain with us, seeing how important it is to have a physical teacher with us. Yeah, very different than just reading Dharma books and then we become just armchair Buddhists. Yeah, but to look at how we can practice and really associate with a teacher who really shows us the way and guides us, because they set an example for us, you know. And it's really an amazing practice to engage with Geshe-la more and more, and to see and observe how we operate, or to have an example like His Holiness the Dalai Lama in our presence. You know, what a very powerful practitioner he is. So so let's sit for a moment and then think about the importance of a teacher for ourselves. And we'll recite that verse. May the Vajra body, created from the purity of clear light, free of the rising and setting of cyclic existence, but visible to the ordinary viewer only in its unsubtle physical form, stay on unchanging without waning until samsara ends. And then this last one is really about dedicating the merit. So let's read that and consider the import of those words. May whatever virtue I have gathered here beneficially serve all sentient beings and the Buddha Dharma, and especially may the essential teachings of the unerring master Tsongkhapa shine forever. And we'll recite this verse to Lama Tsongkhapa three times. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, tainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lozang Takpa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lozang Dapa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. Jai Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the holy masters of the land of snows, you are Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of inconceivable compassion, untainted by ego's delusion. You are Manjushri, powerful master with stainless wisdom. You are Vajrapani, destroyer of forces of demons. At your feet, famed Lozang Dapa, I humbly bow and earnestly request that all sentient beings achieve enlightenment. So as you can kind of see by the description, Avalokiteshvara is the Sanskrit name for Chinrezi, the Buddha of compassion. And Manjushri is the Buddha of wisdom. Vajrapani is also of power. So here, after making these requests, with the next three verses, the first one is requesting the Guru to come to the crown of your head. So you imagine an image. Again, this is really using your virtuous mind, your capacity to, visualization and pure imagination. So you're imagining the image of Lama Tsongkhapa or your Guru, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So it's an image made of light. Tiny, so you imagine inviting them to sit on the crown of your head, facing in the same direction as you. So imagine having the energy of the Buddha on the crown of your head in the first verse. Second verse, take your lotus seat at our hearts. So you imagine that the image dissolves into light, then descends through your crown. So this light just floods your body. And then the image of Tsongkhapa then appears at your heart again. If you're using His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you don't dissolve him into light. You keep the full image of the Dalai Lama because he's still alive. And then the third verse, then you imagine that it's just the steadfastly staying with you, okay? Inseparable from your enlightened quality of Buddha nature. So we'll say the verse and then pause, and then you can do the visualization for each of the three. Glorious precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at my crown, and in your kindness please care for us, bestow upon us the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. Glorious precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness care for us. Grant us your blessings for our temporal success and for the supreme attainment. Glorious precious root guru, please take the lotus seat at our hearts, and in your great kindness, remain with us. Remain steadfast until we achieve the essence of enlightenment. So Geshe-la has been teaching some of the idea of emptiness, that there is no independent, separate, permanent self-existence of phenomena or ourselves. So bringing to mind any comprehension you have of this, then we'll recite the next two, the verse and the mantra. Unthinkable, inexpressible, wisdom gone beyond, unborn, unceasing, space-like in essence, clearly perceived by wisdom mind, homage to the mother of the Buddhas of the three times. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, so be it. Offer the mandala. Again, make the mandala as beautiful as you can, offering things physical and imagined. By the virtue of offering to you, assembly of Buddhas visualized before me, this mandala built on a base, resplendent with flowers, saffron water and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and moon. May all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniya Tayami. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. From the virtuous merit of listening to the teachings, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of listening to the teaching. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the highest assembly from the virtuous merit of sharing the teachings. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. So Geshe Gelson's in Colorado leading a retreat, and he'll be coming back tomorrow. Losung Gelson is translating for him, as he usually does when he's away in the United States teaching. So Losung was camping all the way on his route out. He drove over, and I was telling him about the format of the retreat and how there's going to be this really amazing gourmet vegetarian cook that's coming again, and he said, "Ah, I'm going to Club Med again." Huh?
Club meditation.
Club meditation. Yeah. Or otherwise, they say, you know, it's like the way we practice in the United States with all the amenities, you know, that they say we're practicing the upper middle path. So I thought it would be good to go over a little bit of what Geshe-la has been teaching so that we have some time to focus and practice on it a little bit more. And so I was going to review the six causes and one effect, but I realized, you know, even though Geshe-la can teach that in 10 minutes, that every point would actually take a whole course. So today I'm going to focus just on the equanimity of and the equality of others, so that we can deepen that. Because His Holiness and other teachers say, you know, that without equanimity, there's no chance of bodhicitta arising. So bodhicitta is a Sanskrit word. Bodhi is enlightenment. Citta is mind. So it's the enlightened mind. It's the quality of enlightenment that we try to cultivate, and doing this by aspiration or intention, the intention to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others, and then there's actual engagement of the practices. So these six causes and one effect, you know, can be part of both of those, and really trying to cultivate the qualities of really seeing others as precious and dear. You know, it's like the practice of attaining enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. Again, enlightenment being, you know, not a place that we go to, but a quality of mind. So really, again, as I was saying in the Seven Limb Practice, it's the cultivating or the accumulation or the acquisition of all the excellent qualities and the purification of negativities. You know? So we do that in order to be of the greatest benefit to all sentient beings. You realize that as we try to engage and work with others, know that oftentimes are because of our delusions or our misconceptions about things and people and situations and circumstance, we make mistakes. We do things in error. We harm others rather than really caring for them. So a big part of our practice is, how do we cultivate those qualities so that we can be of greater benefit to others? So this whole practice on the equality of others, or developing equanimity, is really a prerequisite to really accomplishing that. Now, I was going back in some of Geshe-la's notes from his teachings, and one of them he says is, right now our love and compassion is just more intellectual. And it took me aback for a second, because I thought, oh, right now most of our love and compassion is more emotional, you know, in the way that we engage with others and the way we act upon things. It's more emotional, you know. But when you look at spiritual practice and how we try to work with it, you know, it is much more intellectual than actually having this sense of real, genuine love and care for others. Okay, so do you remember what those six causes and one effect were? Let's go over those before we get to the first part, before the six and the one result. What happens in the six causes and one result? Yeah, good, good. All sentient beings have been our mothers. Again, this is really a big leap for us Westerners, isn't it? All sentient beings have been our mothers. It's really requiring us to look at reincarnation, and if we reincarnated in the past, then we had mothers in the past, isn't it? So it's very interesting. Last night I was watching they made a film called War, The War, something like that. I don't know if people saw it, but the person, the producer who made the film said, you know, it's like 60 million, is that correct? 60 million people were affected, and I don't know if it was, I thought he said died, but around the world. Is that right? 60 million people died in World War II. 60 million. And then he said, when you think about that, every one of them had a mother. And I went, oh, there's our teaching. Every one of them had a mother and father, you know? 60 million people dead because of war. And to think that of what the mothers went through in grieving and loss of their child, usually young, very young men. So this practice, even of thinking of mothers in the human realm, is incredibly powerful. Okay, second one.
Remembering their kindness.
Good, remembering their kindness. Third.
Repaying
their kindness. Good. How can we repay our mothers?
Wanting them to be happy.
Wanting them to be happy, yeah. If they're still alive, what can we do for them? How can we help them and assist them? Telephone them. Give them a call once in a while. Don't just wish them well. Give them a call. That's good. Email them. Send them a card now and then. Yeah. Okay, and then fourth? Cultivating love, seeing all sentient beings as lovable, then generating compassion, wanting to relieve their suffering. And the sixth was the altruistic intention, the wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others. And then the result is bodhicitta. What this practice is doing is cultivating the qualities of bodhicitta, the mind wishing to become enlightened for the benefit of others. So this whole meditation and actual practice is so that we can cultivate those qualities. Okay? So this morning in the meditation class I read, wishing to depart and setting out upon the road, this is how the difference is conceived. The wise and learned thus should understand this difference, which is ordered and progressive. So to see, it's like wishing to help others is different than setting out on the road to helping others. And so it's saying the wise and learned should thus understand this difference, which is ordered and progressive. Because we can jump out on our path and try to help others, but if we are full of bias, prejudice, upset, anger, selfishness, self-cherishing, and self-interest, then our capacity to really benefit others is quite compromised, I think. When you think about when you engage in activities that are really colored by this motivation and mental attitude. Okay, so it's ordered and progressive, and really looking at this idea, all sentient beings have been our mothers. Mothers have been kind to us. So, as Holiness the Dalai Lama says, it doesn't matter if you believe in reincarnation. Actually, he says, I'm going to be really radical in saying that. But he says, even if you just are a good person and are kind to others, that's where it really counts. That's the most important thing, So this whole aspect of reincarnation is something that we can contemplate for a while, and he's not trying to force it upon us, but have us really look and analyze that, given the fact, that we are who we are, we have the interests we have the kind of body that we have, how is it that this came to be? And Buddhism really works a lot on cause and effect and conditions, and that things don't come about from no cause. So who we are really have consequences from our past as well. So it's really looking and contemplating this carefully. So, but before we even go there, there's this practice of developing equanimity, some sense of equalizing ourselves and others. because typically they say we have more self-interest, you know, we're just more interested, and we're positioned in looking at the world from our own point of view, yeah? Our stance. It's like Robert Thurman says, it's why we call it the universe, right? Because it's me at the center, universe. And he says we need to transform that into the Buddhaverse, right? Which is seeing all sentient beings as equally precious and important as yourself. So shifting from this universe to this Buddhaverse. So let's consider that in looking at equanimity. So first, from the other person's side, you can say, from the other person's side, all sentient beings want happiness and don't want suffering. So as you do this, think of different people in your lives that you work with. No matter who they are, whether they're well-positioned or living in a box in downtown LA, that they want happiness and don't want suffering, no matter who they are. And no matter who they are, whether well-positioned or not, we all lack that complete happiness and no misery, no matter who. And the third point is, even though others don't want misery, they're oppressed by it. So looking at it from the other person's side, you know, we can say all these beings, no matter who, through time and changes, you know, all want suffering, don't want misery, but are oppressed by it. So then looking at it from one's own side, from our side, yeah, then we start looking again, like from this universe side, looking at the quality of sentient beings. There are, you can divide them into the three beings, which are beings that we are attracted to, that we find loving and friendly, that we're attracted to. So friends, and then those that are strangers or enemies. So there are these three different classifications. When we look at people, how do we observe them? Now there's friend, enemy, or stranger. So His Holiness was saying, you know, it's like in looking at this, you think, well, some people have helped us and some people haven't. Yeah, some people have harmed us and some people haven't. And is this the way we classify sentient beings? Is this the way we hold others in our lives? So no, Thupten Chodron has that question that comes up. She says, if somebody smacked you yesterday, and then helps you today, and then somebody helped you yesterday and hits you in the face today, who would you call your friend?
Maybe it balances out when we become strangers.
Right, keep them all at a distance, right? Yeah, it's really, really interesting that but he says, you know, it's like when you think of our friends, you know, oftentimes they're the ones who have helped us, who have cared for us, who have nurtured us, who have done really good things for us, and then we consider them our friends. And then, you know, strangers we hold a little more far distant because we don't have that much connection with them. There's not much energy. We don't have, you know, too much interaction going on there. But His Holiness says to look a little more carefully at other sentient beings. You know, how even within that, we tend to have bias and prejudice, even though strangers are one big class of people, and how among them, you know, they're all wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. So look at the way, you know, when you go to your favorite restaurant, how do you hold someone like the busboy or the checker at the market or your postman? So people that we may or may not have that much interaction or activity with, but to see how they're benefiting us all the time. Yeah. And then he did a meditation on looking at other sentient beings like animals. How we feel like animals aren't really helping us. And look at the way we hold animals as human beings. You know? That we're all, that we control them and manipulate them. That they become part of our, you know, farm-fed fish and cattle and chickens. And they're all nurturing us, feeding us, helping us. And yet we just kind of keep them at bay. He says, you know, think about the pain and suffering of why would sheep on the way to slaughter be fighting with each other and bucking each other when they're all going to slaughter? That where's the sense of care and compassion when they're going to become our food? So even as animals, there's this sense of generating compassion and care for them. So it's looking at, from our own side, looking at the qualities of other creatures as well. So this one about enemies, this one is a really good one to work with. How do we develop equanimity for our enemies? People or beings who have really harmed and hurt us. You know, look at how we hold grudges when they've hurt us. So, you know, I mean, His Holiness says in this particular teaching he was giving, you know, it's like, he says, when we listen to teachings, oftentimes, you know, we think about these suffering sentient beings and we raise our eyebrows. He kept talking about how we raise our eyebrows, you know, thinking about all those poor mother sentient beings. Yeah. But then when they're really bugging us, yeah, we carry a lot of aversion and anger inside anyway. So, I wanted to read a verse here. And it's also from Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. It says, for one who is impermanent, to be really attached to one who is impermanent is absolutely senseless. For one who is impermanent, to truly hate one who is impermanent is absolutely senseless. Yeah. So again, to think about how in all of our relationships, friends, enemies, strangers, you know, we're all impermanent changing beings, constantly shifting and changing. So, you know, and why fight and look at that? You know? So let's take a few moments to look at our significant relationships, okay? And look at the sense of how, especially in this friend, enemy, stranger, oftentimes, you know, the persons that we have aversion or anger toward are the ones who are closest to us. So you might want to work, say, with your neighbors or your relatives, or someone like this, and really, really consider and look at the sense of how, in fact, it's constantly shifting. It came about through causes and conditions, right? If someone hit you yesterday and was kind to you today, and if someone was kind to you yesterday and hit you today, how are you going to hold them? Okay. So, any questions before we start? Got it. Okay, so let's focus on that for a few minutes. So call someone specifically to mind. Yeah.
I do have a question actually.
Uh-huh.
When you were talking about it's irrational to hold attachment to someone or to hatred towards someone because they're impermanent. I'm a little hung up on the idea that there's that tiny, you know, indescribable piece of something that someone is that goes from lifetime to lifetime, the white drop and the red drop. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, I think that, are you considering the permanence of the person through the white drop and the red drop? Uh-huh. Well, it's kind of beyond my capacity to really to speak on that. But white drop and red drop are physical drops. And when you look at the continuum of consciousness, consciousness is not a thing. Consciousness is not a form. And so what travels on in the view of the Buddhist view is more a very subtle consciousness. It's subtle consciousness that moves on, and propensities towards doing something. So whether someone has tendencies towards real compassion and care for others, or towards hurting and harming others, we carry some propensity and inclination towards doing something like that. And we also carry what they call bhaktaka, habituation toward it, or and also the karmic consequences. So I think that is more I think we can continue that afterwards, because this particular meditation is really looking at equanimity of our relationship to others and ourselves. So, okay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh, Mamie.
Isn't that essentially what we're looking at is in this lifetime, the impermanence that we will be dying? I guess less is why you want to argue with the corpse. That doesn't mean that our continuum doesn't go on. It just means that from now on, we should let go and not feel so concrete.
Right.
Not here forever, and that other person forever either.
Yeah.
So we can let go.
Yeah, impermanence, but also on the side of equanimity. It's not particularly death meditation per se here. You know, we're just looking at the condition of self and others, that all beings want happiness and don't want suffering, and that no matter who they are, whether it's a friend or a stranger or an enemy, you know, that we all have this particular condition. And that's all we're looking at. I think the scope of our meditation is what we're doing here is just limiting it and not particularly looking at past or future lives, or the fact that we're going to die per se. You know, what we're looking at here is just limiting the meditation to the fact that we're all in equal conditions of wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. Okay? Perhaps some of you might want to work with a particular meditation that Kunu Lama Rinpoche had shared with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and he talks about how, you know, you can imagine yourself kind of just sitting as an impartial person. So you're the meditator observing this, and you take into mind maybe about 12 or 20 people that are in your life that are have these different conditions of need and want and concern. And then you're sitting on the other side, and you exaggerate the stuff of your own self-cherishing, your self-interest and self-concern. So you just observe that in this meditation, where you have all these other beings that are in your life, maybe your neighbors, the persons that you work with, family members, people like this, and then yourself, just kind of exaggerating a little bit the self-care, the self-interest, you know, or the uncare, I should say. Okay, so it's more like that, where you're observing as the meditator what happens when you are so just full of this self-interest and there are these other beings in your life. Okay, so let's work with that. Okay, so just kind of limit your meditation to just this kind of a space of self-concern versus developing equanimity, seeing others as having the same conditions as we. Okay? And turn your meditation towards real self, towards understanding others, those people in your meditation, having a sense of interest and care for them. recall the point that no matter who they are, all sentient beings want happiness and don't want suffering, and yet are oppressed by misery. And develop a sense of equanimity for all the people that you've focused your meditation on, whether friends, enemies, or strangers. Any comment on your meditation?
Mm-hmm. Just clarify the visualization. I, as a meditator, am watching objectively myself and then a group of other people.
Right.
It's not this myself commenting on me. It's me watching how ridiculous this person looks.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Right. Yes. Interesting, as Holiness, you know, was asking Kunal Lama Rinpoche if that was a good practice to do. And he said it was very helpful, you know, to have that opportunity to just sit back and look objectively at this ridiculous side of being so disinterested in others and so, you know, full of self-cherishing. So what'd you get?
I could see how it could lead to ridiculousness. It wasn't over there, but I could see it about it.
Yeah. How about the side of working with people that are difficult, say enemies? Yeah. Did anybody work with that? Somebody that you're being challenged by that?
There was someone on Friday that I work with who just doesn't get it.
And he doesn't get it.
There's no trust, and I have to work with her, and she just doesn't get it.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to figure out how to deal with it.
You have to work together. Right, right. She doesn't get it. Do you think that maybe she thinks you don't get it?
There's no trust.
Mm-hmm.
When the trust has been broken before.
Yeah.
And try to build it, and it breaks. Try to build it, and it breaks.
Right. Yeah. It's very hard working with developing equanimity for people that you've had a lot of trouble and difficulty with. Mm-hmm. But, you know, where is there any good in that, in this practice? Do you sit there and just get more upset?
I think it's good for building skillful means and realizing that, you know, there's not a cookie cutter answer, and
mm-hmm.
it's on, you know, our part a lot.
It's on us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah. I know. I think, you know, it's every individual case. There isn't a, you know, a stamp that you can use just to try to eliminate or transform the enemy into a friend. Very, very challenging. You know, going through Geshe-la's notes again, at one point he says, you know, you're the reason why you're still circling around in samsara. It's not because of them, you know? It's because of us, and it really is about our practice and our developing the sense of equanimity and love for others and skillful means. Yeah, so yeah, the meditation part is very powerful in helping us get that perspective to step back and look and see and watch our actions, to watch our mental attitudes about it. Yeah.
I had the thought of giving the other person what she wants, meaning that my perception has been that this person wants to talk to me about things that don't seem to have any real context with maybe the relationship or even the immediate surroundings, just talking, you know? And so I have a tendency to sort of stay busy with other things or be evasive in that, but I thought if I gave that person what they want and maybe initiated wanting to hear what they have to say and giving them, you know, whatever amount of time, how that might change my perspective on the interaction.
Right.
Because it's a regular occurrence, and I'm always asking myself, what does that have to do with anything, you know? But in actuality, to that person, it's important.
I think you're voicing what he's going through. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there is this initial internal attitude that arises where we want to dismiss others because they're not getting it, or they're just taking up my time, and I've got other things to do. I'm too busy, you know. So, again, it's the whole practice isn't about allowing people to walk all over us either, because that can happen too, where, you know, you give them an inch and they'll take a mile, isn't it, right? And they'll just keep talking on endlessly ad nauseum. But it's like, again, where's the skillful practice and means of being able to hear them appropriately, acting appropriately, and then skillfully saying, you know, let's focus on this, keep them on the topic, keep them on the task, and say, you know, sometimes we have to set really clear boundaries with others too, you know, and say, well, we can talk about this for 15 minutes, or I've got an hour for you, and then to help them keep on task. So, you know, I mean, it's not my place to be the therapist, but also, you know, it's like, how do we develop the skillful means to work with this difficult and challenging occasion that arises? So, you know, it's in the practice, in the meditation practice, you know, another way of doing this is to visualize someone that you love, someone that you have difficulty with, and an enemy, and then try to watch what arises in that. You know, and as Holiness says, you know, it's like when you practice or consider working with someone who's an enemy or someone who's very difficult to work with, he says that's like such a gift, because, you know, it's like you'll have all the time you want for someone that you love, you know, or that you enjoy working with. But the real testing of your patience and testing your mettle really comes when you're working with someone who's challenging and different. You know, can you hold them in your heart in the way of having this kind of equanimity and compassion, seeing that, you know, sometimes people are slower to get it than others. Sometimes it's just because of the way that we're trying to speak to them, they don't understand, you know, yet someone else comes along and they get it like that. So sometimes I realize it's because of myself as well, you know, that people aren't getting it, So, you know, maybe you can call someone in to help clarify what's trying to be communicated, something like that. But it's really also looking at this practice of, you know, how do we transform and deepen our own compassion and love for others, even though it's we're being challenged. Yeah. Anybody else work on that? Have that arise with the difficult person?
I have a difficult situation with my son, and you know, it's always a challenge for me. I always think about how much energy do I put into making this better, thinking, oh, it's never going to get better, because, you know, and how much versus, you know, how much energy should I spend trying to shield myself from the situation and make myself calmer and at the same time better for everybody else. So, I don't always come up with the conclusion that it's a good thing for me to try to be better with him. Sometimes I come up with the conclusion that it's better for me to try and be truer to myself and to everybody else.
Yeah, it seems like you would need both, you know, both being true to him and to yourself.
Well, and yes. But I think this whole concept of equanimity with others, I mean, I always divide it in two parts. Into being better with everybody else, with people that I don't know. You know, how can I just be nicer right now to the five people that are around me? And how can I work, on the other hand, on a difficult situation? And I lose faith. I don't always think that there's a way, or I don't always see this. I don't have a skillful means, I guess, to deal with a difficult situation. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody, I guess, finds a balance between these two.
Yeah. Well, I think that you're also sharing, you know, the challenges of being a parent, too, and having that kind of space and time for yourself, mm-hmm. and then giving them real quality time. It's giving the mm-hmm. child excellent attention and interest and engagement. So, you know, it's. I think one of those things of having people that are so close to you that, you know, oftentimes this is where the most strife comes up, is because they're a little bit too close to us, you know. And so so it's really, again, important that we find the situation that we can also recharge ourselves, that we are able to continue to work with others and be with others. Yeah. So let me see what His Holiness said as well. With working with difficult people, you know, he says then these are the ones that are our supreme teachers, because they're the most challenging for us. And generally, you know, they're the ones that are so different from us that we grate on each other because of being opposite. So, you know, it's like rather than pointing out difficulties, blaming others, holding grudges, and pointing out and blaming, that, you know, we really need to see how this practice works, then, that we're not practicing just to get even with others. You know, it's not about if someone has harmed us that we turn around and just get even with them, but how do we see, you know, that they're suffering as well, that other beings also are limited. And, you know, I was thinking, especially like the way we hold our parents, you know, the way we hold our parents, that thinking of this quality that all sentient beings want happiness and yet have difficulty and challenges and misery in their lives, that our parents have been like this too, you know, have throughout the challenges, they still are our parents, and we hold them, you know, we hold them in the way of, why didn't you do better for me? Again, and I think as adults we have to really try to get over this place of thinking that they were, you know, they done me wrong, when when, you know, unless they're Buddhas, or even if they are Buddhas, maybe they're there really pressing our buttons, challenging us with practice, you know. But it's that side where it's so easy to blame someone that's close to us when there's an upset or a difficulty or something that was not resolved. And so, you know, it's like, how do we come to this place of equanimity and love, even for those persons who are very challenging for us? So, okay, so the third reason I'm working with this developing equanimity is from the ultimate view. Okay, we've been looking at others' view, others' perspective, and then our own perspective, and then the third one is from the ultimate view. So there's a quote from Aryadeva in the 400 stanzas where he says, a doctor is not angry with a patient who is possessed by pain or sickness or spirit. In the same way, Buddha sees the emotional afflictions themselves, yet not the beings in place of the emotional afflictions. No? So it's like, just as a doctor will work with someone who's angry and striking out at them and seeing that as their sickness, you know, in the same way can we try to do that, you know, as the Buddha says. So the Buddha sees all beings as pure. Yeah. The Buddha sees all beings as having Buddha nature and the qualities of the potential to attain enlightenment. So looking from that perspective, you know, all from our side, our own mental afflictions and disturbing emotions prevent clarity of seeing who's there. Yeah. Their mental afflictions and disturbing attitudes, yeah, make it hard for them to live in a more positive, generous way. So the second view is, the second perspective is that there's no certainty with friends and enemies. They don't stay that way forever. They don't stay that way forever. So there's a quote from Gungtung Rinpoche, and Gungtung Rinpoche came to visit our center once as well when we were at La Cienega. But he says, the friend who is dear to one's heart today, just by being carried away with projections, due to a few words of difference, tomorrow can become one's main enemy. Right? So you look at that ever-changing sense of friends and foe and stranger, that today they're our friend, and then tomorrow, no, it's like because of something they said or did or acted on, you know, they switch, and vice versa. An enemy can become a friend, strangers become friends, enemies. And then the third one is that friends and enemies are not perceived by the ultimate mind of the Buddha. So the Buddha is not seeing friend and enemy, no? Seeing all beings with equanimity. Okay. So another point from Geshe Loa's, look at how we impose our views upon others. Yeah, it's our view projecting onto others, friend, enemy, and stranger, and particularly seeing them as permanent Yeah. Even this view, seeing others as permanent, is our view. Our misconstrued view. Okay, so let's just sit for a moment with that and then we'll conclude. So in this teaching on equanimity, observe it from the side of others. Whoever they are, they want happiness and not suffering. They're often overcome by misery. From the perspective of ourselves, whether they're friend, enemy, or stranger, that is changing and impermanent. And from the perspective of the ultimate view or of an enlightened view, they see all beings as pure. That there's no certainty among friends and enemies. And that from the ultimate view, one does not perceive friends and enemies. So in this way then, generate a sense of equanimity. Might call specific persons to mind. Observe those that you are attached to or have challenges with. Or people that you don't have much engagement with. And infuse your meditation with a sense of equanimity. And we'll do the dedication. Now we were reading this morning, and this dedication, the word ke. Makepanam kegurchik. It's may the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been generated is more like generated or produced or cultivated rather than received. And same for the view of emptiness. But we'll read it as it is. Because of these merits, may we quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being into his enlightened realm. May the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been received be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. May the precious view of emptiness, shunyata, that has not been received be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. By virtue of offering to you assembly of Buddhas visualized before me, this mandala built on a base resplendent with flowers, saffron water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and moon, may all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniya Tayami. In the land of snowy mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. Lord Shinrezi Tenzin Gyatso, may you stay until samsara ends. So Geshe-la comes back tomorrow, and he'll continue teaching on Wednesday night. So we'll do our vows together. Angela, we can chat a little more. Thank you.